Welcome to another episode of Tom SciCast, and I'm your host, Tom Kennedy. Now, I've been gone for a while. Yeah, several months. In fact, I think the last time I published a podcast was back in March. Well, I've been kind of busy. We've had a new addition to our family, a new boy, and I've built out my studio office, which I will be almost completely moved into probably in the next few weeks, which I'm really excited about. So as our family grows, I'll have a nice quiet place to do podcasts and do other types of social media that I just love creating content and writing. But in this last year that I haven't been publishing a lot of stuff, new videos or new podcasts, I've really been thinking about a lot of things. And this semester, I'm teaching a class on astrobiology. And this is probably one of the most fun things I have ever done. Not only has it had been really fun, I mean, it's been just absolutely humbling. And I'm also really thankful for all of the students that just took a chance on my class. And in fact, I filled it two semesters that I've taught it with over 60 students. So to anybody in astrobiology that took my class or wants to take it, thank you for jumping in on a new class there, as I'm still trying to figure out what to, you know, how to teach it and what to teach. Well, of course, we're going to talk about aliens in there, right? You know, before I started teaching this class, I thought I had a fairly decent handle on astrobiology, at least the outline of it. You know, I had an idea of what life was and how to define it, and thought I knew that pretty well, right? And then I thought I had a pretty decent idea on some planets and habitability and the history of life on this planet. And this has just been humbling. The more I dive into the research and what people are thinking, the more complex I reel it is. And it's been really humbling. And I had to check my own knowledge, right? I thought I knew something. And the way it goes for most people, right? The more we start to learn, the more we realize we don't know. And when I started this journey, you know, teaching astrobiology and thinking about it all the time, I really didn't know a lot. So I wasn't aware of how much more was actually known and how much people were thinking about these things. So I've really had to change the way I think about things. And I mean, this is humbling. I have to approach this with a little bit more humility. So imagine that, you know, I'm almost 50 years old. I've been doing science for a long time. I've been thinking about astronomy since I was a kid in the 80s. And I'm getting humbled a lot. And it just makes me, you know, like I said, check my own humility here. But here's a really good example of how I've had to rethink what we know or what I know. And the simplest question is, what is life? And we need to know what we're looking for if we're going to go out and look for life that is of independent origins from our planet. And people always talk about, you know, life as we know it. Would we recognize life if we saw it? Now, a couple of things here. I still think quite strongly that if we were to find life, we would be able to identify it. Even though we don't have a good definition of life. And, you know, it started my criticisms, as many of you know, from our textbook definitions. You know, you take a class from Freeman in your freshman biology class, and it lists five characteristics of life, something about energy and metabolism, reproduction, evolution. Oh, I'm missing one. I can't even remember them. And then if you learn it from an AMP class, you know, that author adds in life moves. I'm sure you would expect that from an AMP class, right? Oh yeah, they maintain homeostasis or something like that. So we have these characteristics of life. And then I was like, yeah, that's not a very good way of thinking about life. And then I started reading Nick Lane, his work, along with other authors that are very interested in abiogenesis, Mike Russell, Bill Martin. And after reading some of Nick Lane's book, like Life Ascending, The Vital Question, or Transformer, fantastic books, by the way, and then watching some YouTube videos with those guys on there being interviewed, you know, I thought that I was starting to get a handle on this thing that we call life. And one of the ways they thought about life was, don't ask me what life is, because that implies that life is a noun, an object with these set of characteristics, which we see in our textbooks, right? But instead they said, ask me what life does. And you get this idea that Life is an action. Life is a verb. Life does something. So, of course, you derive from that that life is this action. Life is absorbing energy. It's taking in energy, drinking in energy from the environment and using that energy to create order. And yeah, that's exciting, right? That life creates order. It uses energy to do that. And then it creates order by chemistry, doing these metabolic reactions. And it's from here you start to realize that those five characteristics of life are truly actions. Life is using energy to create order, to maintain homeostasis. These are all actions. And then, of course, if you want to have this continuity of life, it has to be able to reproduce. And since you're copying information, you know, that information can change over time, and then natural selection can kick in, and you've got evolution. And then closely related to this, NASA defines life as a self-sustaining chemical reaction capable of Darwinian evolution. Once again, that's an action. And I was getting very confident in myself that we could define life, right? That we could come up with a definition of life. And in the last year, especially since I started preparing this semester, I began to realize that there really is no one definition of life. It's hard to define something that encompasses plants, animals, fungus, and cells. And how do you define all of these things, all of these things that life does, all of these actions in a sentence? Now, don't get me wrong, I really like NASA's definition. But what I've learned is confining life to a single definition misses out on the nuances and the ways that we need to look at life in order to know where to look for it and what it might look like. So I like to think about life from these different points of view. And as a biologist, my point of view is, you know, we get very focused on reproduction, and a consequence of that is evolution. I mean, that's the whole Darwinian evolution in the NASA definition. And that's, of course, a consequence of reproducing. So that's also kind of ingrained in scientists, or I should say biologists a little bit, like the RNA world hypothesis, because it's easy to imagine life beginning as a self-replicating molecule because that's capable of Darwinian evolution, right? And that might not be the answer to how life got started. So we need to start thinking about life from maybe a geological point of view. My friend that was a geologist, John Rogers, I bring his name up often because he said, you know, Tom, life is an extension of geology. And when you read like Mike Russell, Bill Martin, and Nick Lane's work amongst their other colleagues, they go for the hot vent theory of life. And if you start thinking of life as this extension of geological processes, then what kind of geology might lead us to the origins of life? So I'm firmly in the alkaline vent metabolism first hypothesis. And this is where I was for a long time. Then, of course, you start reading about the physicists and the theoretical physicists. And for a while, I had some criticisms of the way that physicists approached biology. And it didn't come out of nowhere. I would read books and papers by physicists dabbling in biology. And quite frankly, a few of them just really didn't understand some basic concepts in biology, including evolution and specifically convergent evolution. They just completely missed it. So, you know, I thought that the physicists thinking about biology thought about biology much too simply. And why wouldn't they? I mean, physics has a set of natural laws that the universe follows. Now, biology also follows the same natural laws of chemistry and physics, but biology is this much, much more complex system. We got a lot more moving parts. And because we're more complex, there's like, oh my gosh, there's like variation upon variation. There's exceptions to almost everything we find in biology. I mean, even the term black swan comes from the fact that Europeans only knew of white swans and thought that all swans were white until they go to Australia and they find a black swan. And there's a, well, there's your counterexample there to all swans being white. Now, let me don't pigeonhole all the physicists, because a lot of them do come over to biology because we are complex. We are nonlinear systems, and that poses a lot of challenges. And then I started watching some YouTube videos, some podcasts with Sarah Walker. She's a theoretical physicist at Arizona State. And after listening and reading some of her works, I'm still not sure I understand all of it. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. She's a pretty smart lady. But she started to change the way I think about biology as well, in terms of complexity and in abiogenesis. I really like this idea of life is when information takes control of the system. And that makes sense, right? So if you are looking at the transition from geochemistry to biochemistry, something that is not living to something that is living, and that's a transition. And when and how that transition occurred, we don't know. But what I'm getting from the theoretical physicist is that at some point, information is becoming in control, is taking control of the system. And I really like that, because in all living systems today, our metabolism, which is, you know, the sum of all of these chemical reactions, life is this emergent property of all of these chemical reactions, but we're taking in energy from our environment, we're creating order and maintaining homeostasis. But that is all controlled by our DNA. So at some point, there had to be this coupling between genetic information and the chemical processes of life. I have no idea how that happened. And in fact, that is the black box of abiogenesis. Now, let me add one more layer to this. We could probably add several more layers of complexity here if we wanted to. Another way to think about life is that life is a thermodynamic system. We are open systems with a constant flow of energy. And as we use that energy to create order, because we're open systems, we actually generate entropy. We actually speed up the heat death of the universe. Life speeds up the heat death of the universe because life is generating entropy. I know, one of my friends really got onto me. He's like, now wait a second, hold on. You're telling me life is creating order but also increasing entropy. And you just have to remember, we are an open system and the universe is a closed system. So as we're using energy to create order at the level of the organism, we actually increase the overall entropy of the universe. Now, that is a very interesting thing, because another statement that I learned from physics that I really like, and I'm trying to remember who said it, but this physicist, he said, basically, everything in the universe happens because of energy flows. Energy flows through life. Life uses energy. Because energy is flowing through life and we're generating entropy, that is a favored state. That is thermodynamically favored. And in the universe, if things are thermodynamically favored, they're likely going to happen. So the evolution of life, or the, I should specifically say, the origins of life, is thermodynamically favored. And then, as life gets more and more complex, like, think about how life has become more complex and more diverse, at each stage, it's using more energy to become more complex. That is favored. And this is blowing my mind. Even the rise of civilization has coincided with increasing energy uses. Our civilization uses even more energy than we did 100 years ago. So thermodynamically, this is favored. And I have no idea how to reconcile that the evolution of complexity is favored, but yet evolution cannot be forward thinking. Evolution is not going toward a goal. And in fact, we talk about the ghost of evolutionary past, that every living thing you see on the planet adapted to something that happened in the past. So it's not trying to get to some goal or some adaptive plateau out over there. But yet, the evolution of complexity is thermodynamically favored. even the evolution of advanced civilizations. And this is just blowing my mind, right? So I'm having to like really think about some of these concepts, whether it's how we define life and the realization that, hey, there really isn't one good definition. Maybe we don't want a good definition of life, a single definition, because each one of those definitions constrains the way we think about it and can limit the way we might search for life, where we might search for life, the way we might understand how life got started. We need to think about life in all of these different points of view, even our evolutionary history. What's driving that? Maybe it is a random walk, which, I mean, almost certainly it's to some degree, right? But maybe those random walks are constrained by the laws of physics, and every time you latch onto something with more complexity that uses more energy, maybe that's just really favored so it's easily kept and not easily lost. I don't know. I'm still thinking about these things. But it's not just abiogenesis, definitions of life. Is evolution the evolution of complexity, both at the organismal level and the ecosystem level, favored? And in fact, animal complexity or complexity of organisms is almost certainly tied to the amount of energy available, and that is also tied to the complexity of your ecosystem in terms of habitat structure and diversity, which is very much driven by how much energy is available and resources, of course, as well. Now, I can go on to other ways that I've really had to think about things that have changed. And one of the most fascinating things about the field of astrobiology is that it is a true golden era of exploration. Back in the 90s, when I was an undergraduate, getting my degree in biology, making some of my lifelong friends, and really picking up the habit of birding and getting into science, one of the things that I kind of felt was that I was a biologist 200 years too late, or at least 100 years too late. Reminded me of a Jimmy Buffett song about, yes, I am a pirate. Yes, I'm a biologist, but I'm really into natural history, and I felt I was along about 100 years too late from the golden era of exploration where you could go anywhere and just everything was completely new. You could find new birds, new lizards, new everything. Now, ironically, my buddy and I, we may have discovered something new recently, so I'm very excited about that. But I always felt like the golden era of biology had somewhat passed us. So today, when we're in astrobiology, we are now in the golden era, golden age of exploration of astrobiology made possible by new technologies like the James Webb Space Telescope, Kepler. We're still learning from Kepler, by the way. And of course, AI, which just really makes it easy for us to sift through enormous amounts of data pattern searching, like finding planets. And of course, we've learned that planets are basically everywhere. But where is everybody, right? Let's look at our own solar system. And man, I've had to just change the way I think about life in this solar system. Last fall, that would be fall of 2022, right? Around October, I gave a lecture on the potential for life on Mars. And I was like, you know, early on, if you'd asked me back in the 90s, I would have said it's a pretty good possibility that there is life on Mars. Then as I learned more about geochemistry and more about the size of the planet, I was like, no, that surface is red. It is oxidized. And if you don't know what oxidized are, but it basically, it's just not good for life because there's really no available energy in oxidized minerals. There's no electrons to donate for energy there. So I'm looking at this planet and I'm going, cold, dead, oxidized world, good luck. You're not going to find life there. Let's go elsewhere. Okay, like 2 weeks after I gave that lecture, the report came out that there was a Mars quake and that Mars was probably more geologically active than we thought. And if it's geologically active, then it's probably got some warm spots. So I had given a lecture on whether or not there was water underneath the ice caps on Mars, the polar ice caps. And they had found dips in those ice caps, just like the dips in the Antarctic, where there are actually lakes underneath there, but a false positive, it could have just been frozen clays, or it could have been way too salty for life to occur, because there's salt puts a boundary on life. So I was like, the planet, based on the models, is just too cold to have liquid water that would be usable for life. But after that Mars quake, now it's possible that there could be hot spots up underneath the ice, and you could easily have liquid water. And not only underneath the ice, we know there are large areas of Mars that have buried ice, actually like within a few feet, meter, of the surface. There could be liquid water underneath it, so Mars, all of a sudden, a lot more possibility for life. And my view on that had to change within a month of me, you know, kind of giving all the reasons why I don't think life was on Mars. Okay, I have another example of life on Mars and how I've had to rethink what I thought I knew and remain open-minded. So when I talked about life on Mars, I at first, of course, read about the results from the Viking experiment, specifically the labeled release experiment. And back in the 1970s, a labeled release experiment basically showed a positive for life on Mars. But the one looking for organic molecules didn't find organic molecules. However, that experiment was known to fail. However, in contrast to that experiment, the one looking for organic molecules, it often failed. The LR experiment, which is labeled release, you basically give it some nutrients with some carbon-14 in there, and if you have metabolism, the metabolism would release CO2 with the carbon-14 in it, the radioactive one. You could detect it. And this experiment worked, and in fact, when they would use the control, they would heat it up, and that would basically fry any microbes in there. They would not get a positive result. And on Mars, guess what? When they sampled the soil, two Viking probes, hundreds of miles away, did the LR experiment, they both got a positive result. But when they did the control, they got a negative result, just like they did on Earth. Also, the failure of the Viking to find organic molecules, it just may not have been simple enough to find it. And in fact, our current rovers, or at least the ones that are still around, Perseverance and Curiosity Spirit, a couple of those are gone now. They died. But the other ones have found lots of organic molecules on the surface of Mars. So this is not a smoking gun for life, but it is evidence for life. One thing that we need to do is look for chirality. But let me add more to this complexity here. In the 1990s, when I was in undergraduate, they discovered these rocks from Allen Hills that looked like they had microbes. And they actually published it. Bill Clinton even announced that we found life or evidence of life on Mars. And there's been a huge back and forth of whether or not what they did was actually discover microbes that were fossilized on those meteors, or whether or not that was just created by some geological process that could have given a false positive. So I've talked to some microbiologists recently, and they're like, it totally could be life. In fact, you can't disprove that it's not, but you also can't disprove that it's not caused by life, right? It could go either way. Just like the LS experiment doesn't prove that there's life, but it provides evidence that there's life on Mars. So one of the things that I've had to think about is I would always be like, yeah, we'll confirm life. Yeah, we'll either find it or we won't. And it could be hard for us to detect it unless we actually see it running around or put it underneath a microscope, right? But what we're going to have to do is build up a list of evidence for it. And this is where I realized that I am biased. And when it comes to science and my outlook toward life, I tend to be very optimistic. Yeah, we're going to find life. The universe is teeming with life. And that's my bias. And I realized that I bring that bias to the way I interpret data. We all do. And in fact, the entire scientific method of hypothesis testing is, you know, this ideal goal of trying to reduce bias in our experiments. But it turns out we're just all really biased, right? Not everybody, but I am. And I think it's important to recognize those biases in terms of our outlook and how we interpret our data. So if you ask me, those microbes in Allen Hills, after talking to some microbiologists, Yeah, I think it could really be evidence of life, just like the labeled release experiment. So that's my bias. If you ask me if we're going to find life in the solar system, I'm probably like, yeah, we got to go to Mars. Europa and Enceladus are probably very good places to find it. And in fact, there are multiple alien oceans throughout our solar system, even Pluto and Ceres and Ganymede and Callisto and Triton and Titan may all have liquid oceans with a rock-water interface, so you can have that extension of geology, right, leading to abiogenesis and ultimately life. But to find life, we're going to have to build up a case for it. And if, like I said, if you're like me, I'm going to be biased to finding it. Now, I've also discovered that there's a bias against life as an explanation amongst astrobiologists. And the reason why is because they want to be very, very sure that what they're saying is actually life, right? That there's this very high bar. And this goes back to Carl Sagan, who once said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So if we find something that's alive, that's an extraordinary claim. We need extraordinary evidence. Well, we have two pieces of evidence already for life on Mars. But there's an anti-bias or a bias that is against life. So instead of saying, yeah, it could be, they're like, no way. It's all geological processes. The Viking lander didn't find organic molecules. It was a false positive. There's no way it could be life. And for me, in my optimistic point of view, you need to be like, yeah, it also could be. But the point is that as I've realized about my own biases, that I also need to be much less dogmatic in my thinking as well. And that's been another humbling thing. Like, every time you think you understand something, especially in biology, there's always an exception. There's always layers of complexity to something that seems simple. Like, you would think that, oh yeah, we found life. That would be easy to identify. Well, unless we actually go to Mars and put it underneath a microscope, we're going to have to build a case that all of this evidence leads to life. Here's another great example. It's been hypothesized that there's these worlds out there called a Hycean world for hydrogen and ocean. So they're like a super Earth. They're not as big as Neptune, but they're about 1.5 to 2.5 times the radius of Earth. That also gives them a lot more mass. So they have these really thick atmospheres of hydrogen, and then they have, you know, these ocean worlds, and it's been thought that they could clearly be habitable planets. Okay, so the same group that predicted Hycean worlds think they found one. Not only did they think they found one, but there's evidence that there's a molecule in the clouds called dimethyl sulfide. Now, on Earth, that is produced by phytoplankton. So we would call that a biosignature. So that is a very good example of what might be evidence for life on this Hycean world. Now, the critics, rightly so, point out that, hey, that signal is really weak. We don't have the statistical power to determine whether or not that's actually dimethyl sulfide in the atmosphere. That could just be noise. We need more data. And I agree with that. It was pretty weak, but it was there. The signal was there. We just need to make sure that it's not noise in the system. So we need to follow up with more observations. The same is true when they found phosphine in the clouds of Venus. We're still not sure if it's there or not, right? I mean, this goes to show the difficulty that Venus is right next door to us, and we can't even come to a consensus of whether or not there's phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus. So we're looking at these Hyceans of worlds tens of light years away, right? It gets harder and harder to detect these things. But if we did find dimethyl sulfide, that would be a case for life on that planet. And with my bias and in my optimistic bent, I would say, yeah, that supports life. That's evidence for the support of life on that planet. Now, here's the humbling part, right? We got to remember this. We still do not know the entirety of chemistry in the universe. A Hycean world could have some really different chemistry than what we have on Earth. You see, our atmosphere is mostly nitrogen and oxygen. Oxygen, of course, is reactive because it oxidizes everything. And nitrogen is kind of inert. It's really hard to split apart nitrogen. I mean, lightning does it all the time, and we have bacteria that can do it in the absence of oxygen. But nitrogen's kind of inert. But if you were to go to a Hycean world where you've got this thick atmosphere of hydrogen gas, hydrogen is like candy for life. Hydrogen reacting with carbon dioxide forms organic molecules, and in fact, we think that's the very first step of abiogenesis. You know, your first electron donor is hydrogen, and your first electron acceptor is carbon, right? Forming some organic molecule. So I could imagine that on a Hycean planet, that the chemistry could be really wild. I mean, it could be rich in organic molecules, maybe. Depends on how much rocks are there and how much minerals like iron and molybdenum and other things that help facilitate chemical reactions, right? So we don't know. So maybe dimethyl sulfide is produced by geochemistry on a very different world than ours, but on our world with an oxygen-rich atmosphere, maybe it's mostly produced by phytoplankton. So as you can see, there's a lot that we just don't know. And in astrobiology, I came in realizing that there's a lot we don't know. But what I did not get was how much we do know. Now, I know that sounds really weird, that we've never discovered another living organism on another planet. Not once. But yet I'm saying we know a lot. And we actually do. We know that there are 5,000 or so planets. We're starting to understand what other solar systems look like. We're finding that most planetary systems have rocky planets, especially the M dwarfs. Now, we don't know if a planet orbiting a red dwarf is habitable or not. Might be, might not be. I could add layers and layers of complexity to that as well, just like we can with the habitable zones. I had a podcast earlier just showing that, like, this very simple concept of the habitable zone changes over time as stars evolve and go through their stellar evolution or their stellar life cycles. But also the type of planet, how big it is, how geologically active it is, how wet or dry it is, also influences where you can have liquid water on the surface. And then the habitable zone and habitability, we turned to our own solar system and realized that we might have habitable worlds way out into the Kuiper Belt just because all you need is liquid water, the rock-water interface, right? So our knowledge is rapidly expanding in the field of astrobiology. Now, what we don't know is what other life would look like, of course. But we can make predictions. So I was also criticized by, I think it's that same friend said, how can you even predict what life is going to look like on another planet? And I was like, no, wait a second. You know, we've got these concepts of convergent evolution. And convergence evolution, you know, basically life is going to converge on very similar answers to a similar problem because life is bound by the rules of physics. But even on our planet, even in our evolutionary history, we've had blue whales, pterosaurs, dinosaurs, bats, bunny rabbits, and bees, and fish, and octopus, right? So even within those bounds of physics and chemistry, the natural laws of how the universe works, life still can do a lot of crazy things. And I always have to check myself because I always feel like I'm a bit of a biological determinist here, that life is going to look in some ways similar throughout the cosmos for the simple fact of convergent evolution. And I'm seriously waiting to see if I'm going to get checked on that as well and realize that once again I was wrong. And in my past trajectory, I have been, but I do think that it will become quite important because even on our planet, like I said, I mean, we have octopus and blue whales in the same ocean, right? With mantid shrimp and humans and bunny rabbits and bats and pterosaurs and birds and all the different types of insects and spiders. We have an incredible variety of life, even within those bounds of the natural laws of nature. So what this allows us to do is to actually go out and make hypotheses. I can look at, like, the Earth is a template and say, okay, if you have this much oxygen in the atmosphere, that's going to limit the size of an arthropod and or anything that has a hard exoskeleton, because we know that through allometric scaling that you're not going to get an ant the size of an elephant, like all those 1950s horror films, B-horror, whatever, sci-fi thriller films from the 50s with these giant insects that had been created through mutations from nuclear fallout or something. That's just not possible. And so there are these limits, and I do think that that allows us to make predictions that are testable. Now, I should say potentially testable, because we can't go out there and test them, at least yet. And this is the last, like I said, frontier for me. Like, am I really wrong? Is life way more diverse in the universe than we think it is in terms of its chemistry and how it looks? Or is life going to be based on very similar chemistries compared to us? And after teaching physiology and cell and molecular biology, that might actually be limiting my imagination in terms of what life could be. But I don't think so. I really don't think so. But as I've talked this whole time about how I've had to like change my thinking, in one way, my thinking has gone much more constrained on what life can look like after teaching plant and animal form and function, you know, basically plant and animal physiology and cell and molecular biology for years. I also teach ecology and evolution. You start to realize that, there might be these limits here. And I really want to know, like, am I once again wrong or am I right? And I do subscribe to the theory of uniformitarianism, that the universe is basically the same everywhere. And according to the physicists, when they see galaxies billions of light years away, those galaxies are operating under the same laws of nature that we're operating under. So that does give me hope that we can make these predictions about life. But our limitations also, once again, come to all the different types of planets. What would life look like under miles of ice on an ice planet like Europa? These organisms would have never seen starlight, but they could have seen light. There could be phosphorescence down there. What would life look like on a Hycean world? What would life look like on a larger world than the Earth? Well, for one, with higher gravity, you'd have to have thicker bones and more muscles. And in fact, if you got on a really big planet, probably the limitations of what you have is terrestrial versus a sub-gas giant like Neptune or something, you might have a really thick atmosphere. You might have a lot of gravity to the point where you can't escape the planet because you don't have chemical rockets that can go fast enough. That's getting a little sidetracked there, something I was just thinking about the other day. But what would it be like to have a really thick atmosphere? And in fact, you don't even have to be a larger planet to have a thicker atmosphere. Just look at Venus. It's smaller than the Earth, but yet it's almost the same size. But its atmosphere is much, much, much thicker than ours. Well, let's say you had an atmosphere that thick, but it wasn't 800 degrees, but maybe 75 degrees on the surface. Could life find a way there underneath that pressure? I don't know. What would it look like? So it gets fun for me thinking about, you know, how life would adapt to a range of different worlds across the galaxy and even across the universe. But I do think we can make some predictions, but yet we have no idea what life might be limited to on a Hycean world that is hydrogen rich. So that's where I'm at right now. I am writing my book on astrobiology, and I'm really thinking about what life might look like in the universe, and not just the organisms as well, but what would the ecosystems look like? What would you need for complex life, complex ecosystems to evolve? What would you need for intelligent life to evolve? Or how about advanced civilizations? What are the steps leading up to that? What would they look like? What would constrain them? So these are the questions I'm thinking about now. And for the rest of this year, my podcasts are going to mostly focus on these larger ideas I'm thinking about in astrobiology. And I might get a really good suggestion from another student. They have good suggestions. You guys have good suggestions. I might entertain a podcast on something. I don't know. It could be anything in science or curiosity or whatever. I like being broad on this channel. I don't want to constrain myself too much, except thinking about the universe. So at any rate, I'm back, and I hope to start putting out podcasts once a week again. And I will also be in my new office, which I'm very excited about. So until next time, which will not be 6 months from now, stay curious. This is Tom Sycast.